Chapter 10. Marching Off to War. The AIDS epidemic had, by the mid-1980s, already become the salvation of the virus hunters. Out of the ruins of the virus cancer program had emerged the virus AIDS program of the NIH. Cancer chemotherapy research had given birth to the AIDS treatment program, including AZT. The CDC had recovered its shaky reputation after the swine flu fiasco and had won a renewed mandate to pursue contagious diseases. The lay public had bought the entire slow virus notion, paradoxes and all. Thus, the virologists had maintained their powerful grip on the biomedical research establishment, and the retrovirus hunters had further secured their position at the very top. But AIDS differed from Legionnaire's disease or the old, intractable problem of cancer. This syndrome had surfaced recently enough to retain its novelty, and it was definitely growing steadily rather than disappearing. Thus, the AIDS epidemic presented the first real opportunity in many years to revive virus hunting on a grand scale. The angst of infectious diseases had originally spawned microbe-chasing wars, the enemies being invisible but deadly germs whose epidemics fed the public's terrified imaginations. Frightful images of polio patients in iron lungs and killer viruses lurking in Africa's rainforests now both haunted and titillated the public. Richard Preston's bestseller Hot Zone and The Coming Plague by AIDS journalist Laurie Garrett stoked the public's fear of deadly viruses while capturing its imagination. And the Dustin Hoffman movie Outbreak in 1994 appeared like a dress rehearsal of the CDC's Ebola virus epidemic of 1995. Fortunately, in both cases, catastrophes were narrowly averted only through the heroic efforts of CDC officials. In Outbreak, CDC officials would even fight a two-front war to stop deadly viruses. True to its reputation, the military was ready to blow up an infected community to stop deadly viruses, but thoughtful CDC officials would contain both military brutality and microbial threats with strategic quarantines, saving lives and banning microbes all at once. While most people had never gone as far as Howard Hughes in his constant hand-washing paranoia, the fear of germs had sustained the glory days of virus hunting. However, not since polio had the public been so anxious over a deadly virus, wondering whether it would strike via kisses, one-night stands, mosquito bites, or public toilet seats. For the virus hunters, the time had come to declare war. By 1986, one man stood out as the obvious general to lead such a war. The veteran polio virologist who had shared the 1975 Nobel Prize for finding the reverse transcriptase protein of retroviruses, David Baltimore, had ascended to enormous power among scientists. He had brandished his award to win a large network of allies throughout the research establishment and even in political and financial arenas. The war on cancer during the 1970s, studies on the immune system by the early 1980s, AIDS in the mid-1980s each allowed Baltimore to enhance his standing as professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Nor did it hurt to establish connections with financial clout. When biotechnology mogul Edwin C. Jack Whitehead offered $135 million to universities, Baltimore seized the chance to establish the Whitehead Institute in 1982. Over the furious objections of many faculty members, he rushed the proposal through and managed to affiliate the new research institute with MIT, from which it lured key professors. Baltimore was named director. Insiders, awed by his enormous influence, referred to him as the Pope. By the mid-1980s, any ambitious scientist knew the importance of befriending him, and he always reciprocated. Those who fell on his bad side faced trouble. Peter Duisberg, for example, publicly raised questions about the scientific validity of cellular cancer genes, and Baltimore retaliated for several years by blocking Duisberg's election to the National Academy of Sciences. Upon hearing that Duisberg had also become a serious candidate for Germany's highest science prize, the Paul Ehrlich Award, Baltimore interceded with an opposing recommendation for his own friends. Whereas a scientist's typical nomination letter includes a few pages of detailed justification, Baltimore's terse letter resounded with his imperial tone. Appropriate nominees for the 1988 and 1989 Paul Ehrlich and Ludwig Darmstetter Award are Drs. Robert Weinberg of the Whitehead Institute and Michael Bishop of the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Bishop also worked very closely with Dr. Harold Varmus, and they really should be honored together. Hilary Kaprowski, a close ally of both Robert Gallo and Baltimore, sat on the prize committee and apparently made sure the panel quickly changed its opinion. Duesberg was displaced, while his longtime research collaborator Peter Vogt alone received the 1988 prize for their joint research on the Ruse sarcoma virus. Although Baltimore's nominees did not themselves win the Ehrlich Prize, Weinberg did receive the General Motors Award in 1987, and Bishop and Varmus jointly won the Nobel Prize in 1989. Baltimore's endorsement was widely recognized as a major factor behind those awards. Such maneuvers also served to marginalize critics of establishment science. Awards served to distinguish the darlings from the dissidents of the scientific establishment. The Blueprint for War. In 1986, Baltimore stood at the apex of biomedical research as the most influential of all retrovirus hunters. Thus, when key members of the National Academy of Sciences decided to launch a war on AIDS, they sought him out to lead the charge. The strategy was simple. A committee of prominent scientific figures would issue a report outlining a program of increased funding to win over researchers in almost every field, all under central supervision. Responding to public fear of a new sexually transmitted disease, it would mobilize the whole population regardless of political views. In other words, it would create a national consensus uniting scientists and non-scientists alike behind the new agenda. Even more ambitious than the wars on polio or cancer, this program would authorize extraordinary measures that might normally meet serious resistance. The research establishment, already by far the largest in history, would expand even more rapidly. Federal spending programs, including Medicare, could also grow in size. Public health officials could implement emergency controls, and even United Nations agencies and foreign governments could get their share of the largesse. The Institute of Medicine and the National Academy of Engineering co-sponsored the project. Funding came from such notable sources as the Carnegie Corporation of New York, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation. 23 prestigious scientists were divided between two panels, with David Baltimore chairing the research panel and co-chairing the steering committee that supervised the whole process. The committee featured Nobel laureate Howard Temin, as well as Paul Volberding and Jerome Groopman, two central figures in the AZT Phase 2 trials. David Frazier, the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service, EIS member, who had led the Legionnaires' disease episode in 1976, sat on the Health Care and Public Health panel. Another EIS graduate, J. Thomas Grayston, sat as chairman of the Epidemiology Working Group. More than 100 other advisors were listed as participating, reading like a veritable who's who of virus hunting. Robert Gallo and various Bob Club members were involved, including Max Essex and William Hazeltine, but none of them were elected committee members. Two major CDC officials participated, as did five graduates of the EIS, including Donald Francis. AZT manufacturer Burroughs Wellcome and DDC producer Hoffman LaRoche each sent a representative. The committee had been given a sweeping mandate to mobilize the entire nation behind the war. As instructed by the National Academy of Sciences, the committee shall evaluate methods whereby the ultimate goals of controlling and combating the disease may be achieved. The committee shall prepare a report outlining a strategy or strategies whereby these concerns can be addressed. The report shall contain recommendations for its implementation directed to the executive branch, the Congress, the research community, those who treat patients, state and local governments, corporate leadership, and the public. Naturally, anyone not cooperating with the committee's goals would be labeled counterproductive, if not irresponsible or dangerous. All the key players in the AIDS virus hunt had their hands in the project, whether from the NIH, the CDC, or the politically well-connected pharmaceutical companies. The outcome was predictable. After two public hearings and a series of private meetings, the committee released its report in August 1986. Entitled Confronting AIDS, Directions for Public Health, Healthcare, and Research, the book became the Bible of the entire AIDS establishment. Its guidelines universally adopted as a blueprint for war. The report made recommendations in four areas. 1. A broad-based research agenda. The committee boasted about the discovery of HIV and its unambiguous identification as the cause of AIDS as a supposed triumph of heavily funded research. Obviously, the reader was expecting from such a high-ranking committee to receive the definitive scientific evidence for the unambiguous identification of HIV as the cause of AIDS. But the best the Blue Ribbon Committee, as it was labeled by the press, could offer were Gallo and Montagnier and an ex cathedra statement that appeared in the 1988 edition of Confronting AIDS. The committee believes that the evidence that HIV causes AIDS is scientifically conclusive. The committee had no more to offer than its belief in Gallo, Montagnier, and other HIV discoverers. Starting with this assumption, the report went on to outline an unrestrained agenda of future research needs. The plan offered something for virtually everyone. Molecular biologists could study the genetic structure of HIV, while biochemists would analyze viral protein functions and crystallographers would examine protein structures. Virologists would inspect every detail of the infection process and develop more tests for HIV, and animal researchers would experiment with mice and chimpanzees alike. Epidemiologists would not only monitor HIV infection in the population, but would also receive vast sums of money to follow cohorts, risk groups of infected people as they lived or died. Pharmacologists would have their hands full developing a spectrum of drugs to attack the virus, the committee specifically suggesting AZT, DDL, and DDC, among others. Of course, vaccines against the virus would have to be invented. Even the social scientists could join in, studying the risk behaviors for transmitting HIV and trying to understand what psychological barriers might prevent the public from adopting the official AIDS doctrine. The common denominator was that all AIDS research should be predicated entirely on HIV. Even with new money pouring in, no room would be allowed for alternative hypotheses. The committee casually listed possible cofactors that might contribute to AIDS, all implying infectious agents, cytomegalovirus or other microbes, genital ulcers as possible transmission routes for germs, and infection by HIV a second time. Psychological stress and diet were added as possible minor contributors. Drug abuse received no mention at all, effectively blocking any research in that direction. Every recommendation of Confronting AIDS has been slavishly followed, whereas a few scientists privately questioned the HIV hypothesis after Robert Gallo's 1984 press conference, this 1986 report and its 1988 sequel bared enough teeth to squelch most remaining doubts. The report also suggested that drugs being tested for AIDS treatment need not rely on all the proper controls, especially placebo groups, a recommendation later used in approving DDI and DDC. Further, the committee's call for an increase to $1 billion in federal AIDS research money by 1990 was nearly met by the NIH alone. And as recommended, much of that money has been used to attract scientists into AIDS research, as well as to train larger numbers of new scientists to add to the growing demand for grant money. 2. Public financing. The committee estimated the staggering costs of medical care for each AIDS patient and decided that it appears likely that future financing of AIDS care will necessarily involve substantial public programs and funds. To make this as open-ended as possible, the report declared that the committee believes that society has an ethical obligation to ensure that all individuals receive adequate medical care. The meaning of adequate was never defined, but since HIV infection was considered inherently fatal and untreatable, this meant providing toxic drugs such as AZT or simply comforting the patient as he died. The committee wanted to ensure that all persons at risk of infection, seropositive or already ill, could make provision for or otherwise be assured that their potential health care costs will be covered. The high price for 1 year on AZT in terms of both health and money, $2,000 per year wholesale, about $10,000 retail, ultimately weighed heavily in those calculations. The key to getting AIDS to qualify for such coverage lay in classifying patients as being disabled. This designation has allowed Medicaid to cover 40% of AIDS patients and Medicare to pay for a much smaller fraction. 3. Public health measures. Any actions to slow the virus were considered justifiable, even if they caused hysteria, encouraged drug use, or impinged on civil liberties. The public health effort directly conflicted with the medical care program, since AIDS patients had to be classified as disabled to qualify for medical coverage, whereas public health controls depended on classifying patients as infectious and therefore deadly to others. The AIDS establishment was constantly issuing such mixed signals, stretching its public credibility. But in the meantime, people have tacitly learned that the AIDS virus is only attacking homosexuals and junkies, and that one is not at risk if one does not practice anal intercourse or does not inject drugs. In the early days of the public health service, decades before the founding of the CDC, federal officers were frequently dispatched to various cities in the midst of disease epidemics. Tuberculosis, bubonic plague, and yellow fever still swept through periodically, but were becoming less common and taking fewer lives as the population became healthier. Hoping to stall epidemics, federal public health agents tried to seize emergency powers by quarantining patients, restricting travel, and taking control of water supplies. But the local citizens and governments usually disagreed with such tactics and resisted attempts at control. In time, serious contagious epidemics disappeared altogether, but not merely because of public health measures. The decline of these epidemics occurred during an era of improved nutrition, the construction of plumbing systems, and rising standards of living. The memories of popular opposition have remained etched in the minds of public health officials, reminding the CDC of its limits. On the other hand, AIDS presented the first opportunity in many years to revive the old public health campaigns. Confronting AIDS recognized this potential, recommending a two-step program of education and widespread HIV testing. The committee gave examples of what it meant by education. This included advocating use of condoms and sterile needles for the injection of illicit recreational drugs, targeted not only at the AIDS risk groups, but at the population as a whole, on the assumption that everyone was endangered by this supposedly infectious disease. Because pregnant mothers can also transmit HIV to their children, the committee noted that the Centers for Disease Control advises women at risk of HIV infection to consider delaying pregnancy. Education also meant damage control in case anyone began questioning the HIV hypothesis of AIDS. In reviewing a survey of men asked about the HIV test, the report expressed dismay at one of the results. The most disturbing finding from the survey was the number of subjects, a majority, who believed that a positive antibody test somehow conferred immunity, that they had successfully fought off the virus. Education would have to change such common sense views. The report recommended easily available HIV testing on a voluntary basis. It also raised the possibilities of reporting these results to central agencies, tracing the sexual contacts of infected people, and quarantining HIV positives, though it dared not explicitly endorse such measures. But stronger controls were not ruled out. There may be need, however, the committee stated, to use compulsory measures with full due process protection in the occasional case of a recalcitrant individual who refuses repeatedly to desist from dangerous conduct in the spread of the infection. In other words, infected people who do not willingly follow public health guidelines could not be forced to do so. The committee effectively opened the door to more radical proposals. Donald Francis, the EIS graduate who had played a central role in blaming AIDS on a retrovirus, has formulated such explicit plans. In 1984, he had already summarized the goals of many CDC leaders with a proposal entitled Operation AIDS Control. He later spelt out these ideas in a 1992 speech to his fellow CDC officials using the audacious title Toward a Comprehensive HIV Prevention Program for the CDC and the Nation. Referring directly to the mandate provided by confronting AIDS, Francis called for five major steps to expand the CDC's authority. First, he wanted the CDC to receive a special status, making it immune from accountability to the voters. The United States needs to establish a separate line of public health authority that allows for accountability, yet is protected from extremist interference. Perhaps the Federal Reserve is an example to emulate. Specific legislation should be proclamated to protect CDC from political interference with necessary public health practice. Second, he proposed guaranteed health care for HIV positives, mostly to lure infected people out of hiding. If we are going to be successful in identifying HIV-infected persons through testing programs, he said, the necessary incentive must be guaranteed health care financing. His third point called for condoning drug use, using the logic that providing drugs to addicts would prevent sharing of dirty needles. Following a more enlightened model for drug treatment, including prescribing heroin, would have dramatic effects on HIV and could eliminate many of the dangerous illegal activities surrounding the drugs. Francis even called this safe injection. But what if heroin itself causes AIDS? If that were the case, taxpayers would be financing the death of addicts. Fourth, he advocated heavier federal intervention in producing vaccines. Finally, Francis issued a call to consolidate public health authority in central hands. Establish clear chains of responsibility, he insisted. The CDC needs to reestablish its leadership role in HIV prevention. Prevention requires close coordination, training, and financial support of state and local health departments. This would subject all public health functions in the country to the CDC's control. Francis then revealed how these powers would be used to manage HIV. The CDC would develop a central registry with the identities of all infected people, gathered from every imaginable source. Whether through hospitals, doctors' offices, sexually transmitted disease clinics, jail health clinics, or whatever, routine testing should be strongly recommended to all patients. The concept of routine, voluntary testing for everyone should be aggressively proclamated as the standard of medical practice. The sexual contacts of all HIV positives would be traced and registered as well, not a simple task considering that fast-track homosexuals typically report hundreds or thousands of sexual contacts. To push the CDC's educational programs in schools, Francis proposed overriding local authority to bypass any resistance from parents. If, in the opinion of those far more expert than I, schools cannot be expected to provide such programs, then health departments should take over, using as a justification their mandate to protect the public's health. Little wonder that Francis boasted of the opportunity that the HIV epidemic provides for public health. Letting down his guard a bit, he revealed the virus hunter within. The cloistered caution of the past needs to be discarded. The climate and culture must be open ones where old ideas are challenged. Those who desire the status quo should seek employment elsewhere. This is the epidemic of the century, and every qualified person should want to have a piece of the action. Parallel efforts abroad. Finally, the Confronting AIDS Committee recommended extending parallel efforts to other nations because infectious diseases know no national boundaries. This meant scientific research collaborations with foreign scientists as well as public health programs in their countries, including condom distribution. The Agency for International Development, AID, has largely picked up the tab, giving millions of dollars to Central Africa. Confronting AIDS specifically called for increased aid to the World Health Organization, WHO, for public health measures. That same year, the WHO released a book outlining its action plan for contagious disease control, Public Health Action in Emergencies Caused by Epidemics. This book was considerably more explicit, describing quarantine, mass immunization, restrictions on mass gatherings, and restrictions on travel, including the formation of a cordon sanitaire, as options when the WHO intervenes in a nation's epidemic measures that would be more politically ticklish to carry out in the United States. Third world citizens, after all, tend to have less power to object to such actions. The committee proposed that a special commission be established to oversee the implementation of the War on AIDS. This was carried out in the form of the Presidential Commission on the HIV Epidemic established in 1987 and lasting for 1 year. The Presidential Commission gathered testimony and issued a report which merely affirmed the guidelines in confronting AIDS. In 1988, the National Academy of Sciences set up a second committee, which included David Baltimore and EIS graduate Donald R. Hopkins as members, that also reiterated the original blueprint and called for yet another permanent commission to supervise the war. Since 1989, the National Commission on AIDS has been sponsored by Congress and the President and continues to echo the recommendations of Confronting AIDS. At times, these officials of the War on AIDS reveal their intent to manipulate public sentiment with carefully crafted propaganda. In 1993, when a major scientific report concluded that AIDS was remaining strictly in risk groups and not spreading into the general population, AIDS officials could not deny the clear evidence. Instead, they angrily denounced the report for allowing Americans not to be frightened. David Rogers, vice chairman of the National Commission on AIDS, told a reporter that his group had worked very hard to try to make AIDS a concern to everyone. Now to have someone say, "We can relax," Roger said, "I would much prefer to have them say, 'You should worry about your own son and daughter.'" The initial Confronting AIDS report has indeed served as the unquestioned standard against which the entire AIDS establishment has measured itself. Virtually all of its recommendations have been carried out enthusiastically in the spirit of true warfare. But when fighting a war, one has little time to ask questions or indulge in scientific skepticism. Such a war requires immediate action, not careful thought. To prevent any mutiny, the AIDS establishment has made sure to control its potential opposition. A rigged debate. To prevent serious criticism or opposition from arising against the war on AIDS, whether among scientists or the general public, the entire nation had to be mobilized to participate. Anyone not enthusiastically joining in would be stigmatized with a label of apathy, and any person raising questions about the HIV hypothesis could be painted as being in a state of denial. The NIH carried out its assignment, lavishing billions of dollars on HIV research. Many scientists quickly learned an easy way to tap into this plentiful grant money, while others knew better than to raise questions, an act that peer reviewers could easily punish. Thus, virtually all scientists marched along without hesitation. The CDC, on the other hand, tended to occupy the front lines as the federal government's major public health agency. Thinking of themselves more as activists than researchers, CDC officers spent much of their time reaching the lay public with prevention measures. Their AIDS activities consisted of more than just HIV testing or distributing condoms and sterile needles. Their largest program dealt with mobilizing the public through education, convincing the general public to join in the war on HIV. The job of inducing the non-scientists to march fell upon the CDC. Traditionally, the CDC has disseminated its views largely through state and local authorities, whether health departments, school systems, or other government structures. But the new mandate provided by Confronting AIDS demanded greater action. The crux of its mission was to persuade the public to see HIV/AIDS as an infectious disease. In the words of one CDC official, "With large sums of new money appropriated by Congress for the purpose, the agency launched its new initiative. Only one major obstacle stood in the way. With its messages always attached to the CDC label, the agency would have limited impact on public opinion. So the CDC chose to expand its existing program for increasing influence with other organizations. The agency started with its traditional partners, the state governments. $10 million began flowing from the CDC to the states in early 1985, allocated for new HIV testing sites. The money was carefully linked to appropriate counseling as defined by the CDC, ensuring that anyone being tested would hear the official line on AIDS. The CDC has continued financing these testing programs. Looking beyond state and local governments, the CDC also recognized the potential for spreading its views through private groups, which have greater credibility as independent voices for their constituencies. The CDC had already targeted some of these community-based organizations and quietly developed ties with them before the publication of Confronting AIDS. It began with the United States Conference of Mayors, USCM, which in 1984 received CDC money for distributing AIDS information. Within months, the CDC began sending increased funding to the USCM, which in turn distributed the new money to private AIDS organizations. Under CDC monitoring, the USCM helped AIDS groups organize and expand their efforts and even use the money to start new AIDS groups. Eventually, the CDC added more funding through state health departments, which also dispersed it to AIDS activists. By the early 1990s, about 300 such groups were funded directly or indirectly by the CDC. Under central coordination, these groups became so closely interconnected that they constituted a singular web of activists. Push a button at CDC headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia, and a nationwide network of ostensibly private organizations would act in unison. To the public, the whole thing seemed quite spontaneous. These organizations, their CDC links invisible to most people, actively spread the ominous message of infectious AIDS. Most of these AIDS activist organizations were homosexual groups, through which the CDC view quickly permeated the entire homosexual community. This influence became so pervasive that some information, even life-saving messages, were blocked from reaching AIDS patients. Michael Callan, a 12-year AIDS survivor until 1994, who worked to give hope to patients, described unexpected opposition from an AIDS activist. "Once, after giving my hope speech during a public forum organized by the Gay Men's Health Crisis, I was angrily pulled aside by a gay man who worked in GMHC's education department. He begged me to stop saying that AIDS might not be 100% fatal. Shocked that a gay man would make such a request, I asked for reasons. He gave three. 1, efforts to persuade gay men to practice safer sex might be undetermined because they would take AIDS less seriously. 2, it was bad for fundraising. And 3, it would make lobbying for increased federal funding more difficult. After all, he said, if not everyone who gets it dies, then maybe AIDS isn't really the crisis we're being told it is." After the publication of Confronting AIDS in 1986, the CDC started branching out to new types of organizations. While continuing to fund AIDS activists, the agency now also directed its money and influence toward other civic groups that could influence other segments of American society. Tens of millions of dollars, for example, flowed to the American Red Cross in a cooperative agreement that gave the CDC an immense degree of control over the organization. The Red Cross used the money to create and widely distribute many millions of pamphlets, videos, and guides throughout the country, as well as to sponsor innumerable presentations in local communities. The American branch even pulled influence with international Red Cross and Red Crescent societies to spread the CDC doctrine around the world. The CDC also infiltrated the National Hemophilia Foundation in New York with its inexhaustible resources, thus selling invisibly the HIV-AIDS hypothesis to the 15,000 HIV-positive American hemophiliacs. The consequences of this collaboration are particularly tragic, as thousands of HIV-positive hemophiliacs were now encouraged to take the deadly AZT to prevent AIDS from the hypothetical AIDS virus. Indeed, the mortality of hemophiliacs has increased sharply since 1987, the same year AZT was licensed as an antiviral drug. Moreover, the National Hemophilia Foundation's endorsement of the HIV hypothesis rigged the debate about the benefits of highly purified, foreign protein-free factor VIII. In the early 1990s, highly purified factor VIII was shown not only to halt but even to cure AIDS symptoms in HIV-positive hemophiliacs. The results revealed that foreign proteins contaminating commercial factor VIII rather than HIV caused hemophilia AIDS, but the benefits of pure factor VIII were obscured by the simultaneous treatment of HIV-positive hemophiliacs with the toxic AZT. Vast sums of CDC money were allocated to dozens of minority and civil rights organizations ranging from the National Urban League and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to the National Council of La Raza and the Association of Asian Pacific Community Health Organizations. Special partnerships were also formed between the CDC and powerful lobbies. Elected representatives in state governments were influenced through the National Conference of State Legislatures. Unionized workers were reached through funding to the AFL-CIO and some of its affiliated unions, including the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, and the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. And school sex education programs were shaped by grants for the Sex Information and Education Council of the U.S., SIECUS. The CDC's influence extended into the schools by funding such organizations as the two major teachers' unions, the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, as well as through the National Parent Teacher Association, the American Association of School Administrators, the National School Boards Association, the Center for Population Options, and many similar groups. The CDC even managed to exploit the raging AIDS debate between AIDS activist groups and the religious right. In addition to the funding for AIDS activists mentioned above, the CDC formed a partnership with the National Association for People with AIDS, NAPWA. This group co-sponsored annual conferences for AIDS activist groups, and the 1992 meeting attracted over 1,000 individuals representing 578 community-based agencies in 1,189 cities and 46 states, as well as Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Japan, Kenya, Ireland, and Portugal. The CDC simultaneously became a partner of Americans for a Sound AIDS Policy, ASAP, which serves as a resource to the religious community and disseminates HIV/AIDS information and publications through 23,000 Christian bookstores. ASAP became the central source of AIDS material for the religious right and advised Congressman William Dannemeyer. Funding these two organizations paid off well for the CDC. The AIDS activist movement championed distribution of condoms and sterile needles, while the religious right advocated mandatory HIV testing, tracing of sexual contacts, and sometimes even quarantines. Both sides called for more funding for AIDS research and CDC programs. The CDC could never lose. The CDC was not the only part of the AIDS establishment providing funds. Burroughs Wellcome joined the act in 1987, once AZT had been approved and was starting to generate hundreds of millions of dollars in sales, profits that company certainly wanted to protect. Since the company's market lay disproportionately in the homosexual community, it had to be sure of encountering little criticism from that direction. The homosexual press quickly fell into line as Burroughs Wellcome began placing high-cost advertising for AZT in virtually every such publication, large or small. Chuck Ortlieb's New York native remained stalwart as one of the few holdouts. Most others embraced the extra revenue. Next, the company turned to financing AIDS activist groups directly. Some 16,000 such organizations exist in the United States, ranging from relatively mainstream foundations that support research to the more radical groups like ACT UP. Burroughs Wellcome has given money to most of them, particularly the extremist groups with the strongest reputations for fierce independence. After the money began flowing to AIDS activists, many organizations began blunting their criticisms of AIDS dogma while keeping up the fiery rhetoric. Few constituents of these organizations noticed the change, and HIV-positive people continued relying on their advice. In the center of the AIDS establishment sits the American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR. It was created in 1985 by Michael Gottlieb, the doctor who reported the first five AIDS cases, and Matilda Krim, the scientist and socialite who helped launch the war on cancer and now played a central role in the war on AIDS. AMFAR gained prominence through its Hollywood connections. It recruited such top names as Elizabeth Taylor and Barbara Streisand for fundraising and publicity, and thus came to dominate public relations for the AIDS establishment. The pharmaceutical companies showed their pleasure with generous donations. Burroughs Wellcome announced a staggering $1 million donation in 1992, and the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation, connected with the company producing DDL, has also provided funds. Toward the more radical end of the spectrum is Project Inform, a San Francisco-based watchdog group founded by activist Martin Delaney. This group gained its fame as a bulldog fighting the FDA based on Delaney's underground testing network that provided various experimental cures to dying AIDS patients. Delaney started as one of the angriest critics of AZT as a toxic drug improperly rushed through clinical trials. He also co-authored a book in 1987, Strategies for Survival, in which he warned active homosexual men against the disastrous health effects of such recreational drugs as poppers, cocaine, heroin, and amphetamines. In addition to emphasizing immunosuppression among the effects, he and co-authors Peter Goldblum and Jay Brewer admonished their homosexual readers not to ignore the dangers of drug abuse. And don't get bent out of shape if your favorite recreational high gets a bad rap. Maybe your use of the drug is so moderate, so cool, that you never bump into the gremlins lurking within. It's also possible that you haven't been a user long enough for the effects to occur. The damage from most drugs is long-term and cumulative, but don't discount the information out of hand simply because it doesn't agree with your own experience or because you don't want to hear it. But aid from the pharmaceutical companies seemed to change all that. Burroughs Wellcome donated $120,000 for an upgrade and expansion of Project Inform's computer system, and Bristol-Myers Squibb pitched in another $200,000. Suddenly well-funded, prestigious, and personally consulted by Anthony Fauci, Delaney changed his mind. When he gave a lecture at Stanford University in 1990, the former nemesis of the FDA now praised that federal agency for its work and sympathetically described it as overworked and understaffed. In publicly attacking Duisberg for questioning the HIV hypothesis, he has issued furious monographs and letters to newspaper editors. Delaney has also dropped his former opposition to AZT. His most recent anti-Duisberg letter, published in Science in January 1995, makes that very point. It argued that Duisberg did not deserve funding for his research because he had called AZT prescriptions genocide. But 2 months later, the director of Project Inform confessed to an inadvertent error. Apology. In my letter of 20th January, page 314, I wrote that Peter H. Duisberg repeatedly and publicly has accused many of those who disagree with him of genocide. This term was incorrectly attributed to Duisberg in a newspaper report that was the source for the quote. I apologize for this inadvertent error. Larry Kramer is another example of a seemingly radical AIDS activist who works closely with the establishment. An angry homosexual rights activist renowned for his bitter language in denouncing AIDS officials, Kramer founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis, GMHC, in 1982. Under his early leadership, GMHC labored to create AIDS activism in a community that did not want to acknowledge the syndrome's existence. Later, after new leaders replaced Kramer and the AIDS epidemic had become institutionalized, GMHC continued spreading the official CDC view of prevention and treatment. This view included endorsing AZT therapy. A former executive director of GMHC did admit to writer John Lauritsen that the group had been receiving money from Burroughs Wellcome, but declined to say just how much. Kramer went on to found an even more radical group, ACT UP, in 1987. Intent on pushing more drugs through the FDA approval process, ACT UP protesters gained attention by stopping rush hour traffic on Wall Street, invading corporate and government offices, and disrupting scientific AIDS conferences. Yet very quickly, these activists became an integral part of the AIDS establishment. Anthony Fauci, the de facto coordinator of the War on AIDS at NIH, began attending ACT UP meetings in 1989 and brought key members, as well as Martin Delaney, into NIH advisory positions. ACT UP members were soon incorporated into AMFAR and other positions of influence. Burroughs Wellcome also developed close relations with the group. An editorial note in the San Francisco Sentinel referring to local ACT UP Golden Gate stated that ACT UP chapters elsewhere have received millions in contributions from Burroughs Wellcome over the last few years. Certainly, the organization has received thousands of dollars. An offshoot group headed by ACT UP New York member Pete Staley, the Treatment Action Group, TAG, is funded by the pharmaceutical company and in 1992 arranged for the $1 million grant from Burroughs Wellcome to AMFAR. ACT UP is also sponsored as a participant at the annual International AIDS Conferences. According to John Lauritsen at the 9th conference in Berlin in 1993, most of the 300 ACT UP members had the 950 Deutschmark entrance fee waived by the organizers. Many had traveled to Berlin staying in hotels with swimming pools with all expenses paid by Wellcome. An ACT UP representative from London admitted that his group had received £50,000 from Wellcome. The relationship has paid off for Burroughs Wellcome and other pharmaceutical companies. Rather than protesting against AZT, ACT UP has demonstrated for cheaper AZT. But not only was Burroughs Wellcome already intending to lower the price, the demonstration itself helped advertise the drug. Some of the signs held by activists read, "What good is a cure if you can't afford it?" Only ACT UP demonstrators could get away with calling AZT a cure. Recently, the group has voiced some criticism of AZT, but nothing that will endanger the drug's status. The group also helped Bristol-Myers Squibb win FDA licensing for the toxic drug DDL. Through colorful street actions and high-pressure negotiations, ACT UP maneuvered the FDA into approving DDL on the fast track, without any controlled animal tests and without any studies at all. ACT UP has also worked to squelch any criticisms of AZT or the HIV hypothesis. John Lauritsen has described his own experiences being shouted down and silenced by members when he attended meetings and tried to raise questions, an experience also relayed to us by other AIDS activists. At the 1993 International AIDS Conference in Berlin, ACT UP took direct action against a small contingent of HIV dissenters whose viewpoint had never previously been represented at such meetings. In front of the ICC, the conference center, Christian Joswig and Peter Schmidt were attacked by several dozen members of ACT UP, who destroyed signs, burned leaflets, and attempted to destroy camera equipment. Conference officials witnessed these acts and then ordered the victims of the assault to stay at least 100 meters from the ICC. Officials took no action against the attackers from ACT UP. Also, on the 10th of June, 100 ACT UP members destroyed a booth belonging to AIDS Information Switzerland. They chanted obscenities, smashed panels, destroyed displays and chairs, and tore up literature before covering the remains of the booth with 30 rolls of toilet paper. The Swiss group's sin had been to criticize condoms. The communications media is naturally another target for the war on AIDS. The CDC leads this charge, funding such groups as the National Association of Broadcasters, which is the Broadcasting Industries Trade Association, representing the major networks and some 6,000 individual radio and television stations. More important, the entire network of CDC and Burroughs Wellcome-funded organizations effectively serves as a powerful lobby, both in government and in the media. Politicians and journalists alike, when not consulting the CDC directly, usually get AIDS information from one or more of these many organizations on the assumption that all these groups function independently. These avenues give the CDC an impressive hold on the media, allowing it to promote fear of an AIDS explosion while saving the HIV hypothesis from embarrassing public relations disasters. Thus, the CDC has been able gradually to lengthen the supposed latent period between HIV infection and AIDS from 10 months to 2 years, then to 5, then to 10, and now approaching 12 or more years. The agency has also created an illusion of the spread of AIDS, pumping up the number of cases by redefining the syndrome. In 1985, the CDC first expanded the list of diseases officially called AIDS. Again, this happened in 1987, artificially increasing the annual caseload by 5% or more. The definition was expanded again on January 1, 1993, adding such diseases as bacterial pneumonias, tuberculosis, and even low T cells in healthy people as AIDS-defining conditions. The increase in AIDS cases has resulted more from this statistical trick than from a genuine rise in sickness. A more critical media would have noticed such maneuvers and would have asked questions. Stories can also be squelched when they become too embarrassing. The January 20, 1990 issue of the medical journal Lancet contained two adjoining papers on Kaposi sarcoma. The first, with CDC official Harold Jaffe, a senior author, acknowledged that the disease mostly targeted homosexuals with AIDS, consistently avoiding the other risk groups. The second paper reported 6 HIV-negative homosexuals with Kaposi sarcoma. Duisberg had previously raised these data as arguments against the HIV hypothesis, a fact ignored in these papers. The authors therefore recognized that Kaposi sarcoma might not be caused by HIV, but they, and presumably the CDC, wanted instead to blame some other undiscovered infectious microbe. The news media gave this story some attention, but during the following weeks, this news only helped the case against the virus AIDS hypothesis. As a result, the CDC dropped the issue and the story died completely. But in December 1994, the story was suddenly resurrected. After 10 years of championing the HIV hypothesis, Science magazine asked, "Is a new virus the cause of KS, Kaposi sarcoma?" The journalist in charge of the story apparently did not realize the heresy implicit in such a question. After all, Kaposi sarcoma has done more for the awareness of AIDS than any other AIDS disease. Kaposi sarcoma had risen from pre-AIDS anonymity to become the signal disease of the AIDS epidemic. No other AIDS disease has increased so much over its pre-AIDS background as Kaposi sarcoma. Therefore, Kaposi had become synonymous with AIDS. It was for this reason that practicing physicians accepted AIDS so readily as a new disease. Most of them had never seen Kaposi sarcoma in young men before AIDS. But if HIV was no longer the cause of Kaposi sarcoma, was it still the cause of other AIDS diseases? That is the question that Duisberg asked in a letter to Science on January 20, 1995. If the domino theory applied to AIDS, losing Kaposi sarcoma to another cause could spell trouble for HIV as the cause of remaining AIDS diseases. The CDC's carefully crafted empire of 30 AIDS diseases was held together only by their presumed common cause, HIV. The CDC realized the danger and immediately stepped in for damage control. Their strategy would be first to confine the damage by restricting non-HIV AIDS causes to other viruses, and then to cautiously call each new virus into question. The CDC's director for HIV/AIDS, Harold Jaffe, and four other CDC officials jointly wrote back to Science. We read with interest the report, Identification of Herpes-like DNA Sequence in AIDS-Associated Kaposi Sarcoma. We hypothesized that if KS is caused by a herpes virus, antiviral agents with activity against herpes virus might also decrease the incidence of KS. To test this hypothesis, we examined persons 13 years old or older with human immunodeficiency virus or with AIDS in 10 metropolitan areas in the United States. Of the three antiviral medications evaluated, only Foscarnet was associated with a significant reduction in the risk for KS. The letter put HIV back in the picture by testing an antiviral drug in persons with human immunodeficiency virus rather than in persons with the new Kaposi's virus. The result was as obscure as the design of their experiment. A recent report indicated that KS improved in 3 of 5 patients with the use of Foscarnet. While it is known that Foscarnet has some antiviral activity against HIV, it is doubtful that the activity against HIV alone could account for the reduced risk of KS. Even if HIV proved to lose out against the new virus as the cause of Kaposi sarcoma, the CDC's letter reconfirmed the legitimacy of the antiviral therapies and prevention developed in the war on HIV. However, the CDC's defense of viral AIDS carefully avoided any direct reference to Duisberg's strategy to break all HIV-AIDS links because one HIV-AIDS link had been broken. The legal strategy of falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus. This was done in a parallel letter by the discoverers of the new herpes virus-like DNA sequences in Kaposi sarcoma in no mistaken terms. The convoluted logic of Duisberg suggesting that our findings support his hypothesis that HIV is not the cause of AIDS escapes us. If one assumes that KS is caused by a herpes virus that may be transmitted both sexually and non-sexually, continued safe sex practices by both HIV-positive and negative individuals may limit the spread of this agent as well as that of HIV. Although the discoverers of the new herpes virus-like DNA sequences had yet to isolate their virus from a sarcoma, they already assumed it was sexually transmitted. In sum, the status quo had been restored. To think that HIV was not the cause of AIDS, even if it was no longer the cause of Kaposi sarcoma, was identified as convoluted logic. Continued safe sex practices would now be even more necessary than ever to prevent the spread of two AIDS viruses. An even more spectacular example briefly stunned the world in July of 1992. HIV dissidents had for some time pointed to the existence of people with AIDS diseases, but no HIV infection as the definitive argument against the HIV hypothesis. Then, just before the 8th International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam, Newsweek suddenly published an article by reporter Jeffrey Cowley on several HIV-negative AIDS cases. The article mentioned unpublished research by two laboratories suggesting the discovery of a new retrovirus. Rumor had it, the scientists had leaked the story to Newsweek so they could blame HIV-free AIDS cases on a new virus. In any case, one of them had already submitted a paper reporting a new retrovirus to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which would not be published for several weeks. Anthony Fauci jumped on the potential bandwagon, calling up the editor of the Proceedings to pressure him into publishing the paper immediately. Researchers at the AIDS conference interpreted the Newsweek article as a green light and began unveiling dozens of previously unmentioned HIV-free AIDS cases in the United States and Europe. The situation began reeling out of control. Rather than merely promoting the idea of two AIDS viruses, the media fallout unintentionally started reopening the question of whether HIV caused AIDS. James Curran of the CDC and Anthony Fauci of the NIH raced to Amsterdam on Air Force Two to take charge of the situation. The best they could do was to listen to all reports of such cases and promise to resolve the situation. In reality, they had decided to drop the whole matter. 3 weeks later, the CDC sponsored a special meeting at its Atlanta headquarters. The scientists reporting HIV-free AIDS cases were invited, as was Cowley, the Newsweek reporter who first broke the story. The unexplained AIDS cases were relabeled with a highly unforgettable name, idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia, or ICL, so as to break any connection between these cases and AIDS. The ICL cases were then dismissed as insignificant, and Cowley was apparently persuaded to cooperate more closely with the CDC in the future. His next AIDS article towed the official line perfectly, containing little news, and he never again followed up on the growing list of HIV-free AIDS cases. In February of 1993, a group of papers was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, accompanied by an article by Fauci with the title CD4T Lymphocytopenia, Without HIV Infection, No Lights, No Cameras, Just Facts. Ironically, imitating arguments straight from Duisberg's critique of AIDS, he concluded ICL must not be infectious at all. Fauci argued that the number of AIDS-defining diseases now called ICL was far too large and the diseases were too heterogeneous to be caused by a single virus. Fauci also insisted that the epidemiology of ICL cases set ICL apart from AIDS, as about a third of all ICL cases were women, compared to only 10% of cases in AIDS. However, Fauci seemed to have forgotten some of his very own facts, that HIV is said to cause all 30 AIDS diseases by itself, and that HIV is said to cause an epidemic in Africa in which 50% of the patients are female. After Fauci's article, the issue had died, and so did the media coverage. Roma locuta, causa finita, Rome has spoken, the case is closed. Lawrence Altman, the EIS alumnus who had become the head medical writer for the New York Times, meanwhile admitted he knew of cases for several months but did not break the story because he didn't think it was his paper's place to announce something the CDC was not confident enough to publish. No one bothered asking why a top reporter would feel obligated to follow the CDC line. Duisberg has personally been informed by at least two scientists in the San Francisco Bay Area who work with dozens of HIV-negative AIDS patients who, because of local and national pressures, have been intimidated into concealing these cases. This may well be a nationwide problem, with untold numbers of HIV-free AIDS victims remaining unreported. According to the British magazine Continuum, fear of the AIDS establishment is not restricted to the United States. A doctor at Charing Cross Hospital in London, England, just admitted to Continuum that he has a case of Kaposi sarcoma in an HIV-negative gay man. The doctor, who wishes to remain anonymous because he fears the consequences of speaking out, has said that many doctors are aware of major problems with the HIV-AIDS hypothesis, but no one wants to put their head above the parapet. By funding AIDS activist groups, the CDC and pharmaceutical companies have created yet another type of influence over the media. These activists can either directly co-opt or intimidate reporters, who often depend on the activists for news stories. Lisa Krieger, medical reporter for the San Francisco Examiner, revealed some of the more common tactics. I'm often attacked by AIDS activists whose unspoken assumption is that either I'm on their team or against them. When I write about the need for reform in San Francisco's AIDS infrastructure, I am called uninformed, insensitive, and racist. When I dare criticize an AIDS organization, I'm told I am writing self-serving drivel or passing on rumor, gossip, and innuendo. Though denying she is influenced by such pressure and insisting that her reporting is objective, Krieger nevertheless admitted some of her normally unspoken biases in her attitude toward AIDS reporting. How could I resist in my weaker moments becoming an AIDS advocate? I want to reach through the newsprint and grab the reader by the collar, as if that would somehow shake the complacency with which the public has come to accept this disease. I want to applaud every new clinical drug trial, elevate AIDS activists to sainthood. One startling example of such media bias appeared in September 1993, when a New York City resident who rejects the HIV hypothesis of AIDS wrote a letter to the New York Times. Although critical of AZT therapy, the letter was published. However, the newspaper actually added words immediately following a reference to HIV. The Times inserted the phrase, "which causes AIDS."